For me, it's saying, yeah, I did this really hard thing and it didn't work out. And I'm still good with that because I put myself out there to do something that I didn't think I could do. And I tried anyways. Then I learned from that. I built a better team. I looked at better weather. I built up my strength, my capability, and I tried again. Time's not related, is your currency.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Eat Green, Make Green podcast. This is Pat McCauley, as always. My guest this week is the incredible Christina Rivers. Christina is a cyclist based in Australia who just about a week ago set the Guinness World Record, unofficially. It's still being vetted, but I'm 100% confident that it will be the world record for the fastest woman to cross Australia on bike. And the most inspiring aspect of it all to me is that she is not some pro cyclist. She is not some pro athlete. She is a mom of two with a quote unquote normal job and normal life that decided she was going to set this crazy goal that is way above her pay grade. She's not even the fastest cyclist of her friends. You know, she, on her casual rides in the weekend, she's one of the slower ones that gets dropped. And she had the courage to set this goal. She was probably laughed at for even setting it. She attempted it 6 months ago, failed at it, and then once again had the courage to dust herself off, take all the lessons from the first one, now knowing how incredibly hard it was as well, and still having the courage to step up to the plate again and swing for the fences again, and now accomplished it. And I think there's so many lessons and takeaways from that that we get all into in this conversation. And we talk about how she prepared for it and the incredible challenges she encountered and the mental techniques and hacks that she used to push herself forward and accomplish this mighty goal as this relatively average everyday athlete. The other cool aspect for me was she rocked Plant Athletic gear the entire ride. So we were just so fortunate to be able to support her in the ride and connect with her. But I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let her tell the rest. Without further ado, the one and only Christina Rivers. Time's not related, is your currency. All right, I have the Christina Rivers with me. This is, to my knowledge, the first time I'm speaking on the podcast to a Guinness Book of World Records holder. So welcome. This is a first for me.
Thank you, Pat. We still have to go through the requirements. It'll be about 3 months till we see that certificate. So we'll say
record pending. Okay, so it's unofficial.
Thank you.
Unofficial. Okay. What is that process? How long does it take to actually make that a record officially?
Yeah, so there's quite some structure around getting a Guinness Book of World Records. And this is for a bicycle attempt, I should say, across Australia. So we had to submit the route in advance and get it approved to initiate. And then we had rules while we were out on the road requiring signatures, X amount of footage required a day, and no drafting rules, and a few other things. And then all of that has to be compiled to GPS pieces as well to validate the ride. And then all of that will go to them, and then they'll validate and make sure that it is actually a legit record, which I think is about another 3 months if we don't want to pay the $5,000 to expedite it.
Got it. Yeah, probably not worth expedite, right?
No.
So for people that don't know, you unofficially are the fastest woman to bike across the country of Australia. And I guess a good place to start with a conversation is, why'd you decide to do this?
Yeah. Why? Why do we do the things that we do? So for this attempt to try and ride my bike across Australia, which is 4,000 kilometers in record time, it was a pretty big audacious goal that formulated during that lovely COVID period we all had. And I was just feeling so stuck and confined in our day-to-day and wanted something really big to break out of that and to plan towards. And it was highly motivated to have such a big goal on the horizon to get out for those daily rides and to keep the consistent riding and the consistent healthy patterns as well. The whole lifestyle required to achieve that kind of goal. So that's really what started it for me. And part of my work in professional services is to inspire others to make big, bold, beautiful decisions. So I really put it on myself to live what I teach and to think of something that was so big beyond my capability to reach for. So when I first came up with the idea, Pat, I didn't actually tell anybody because I was so embarrassed. And when I did tell people, I would giggle a little because I knew it sounded a bit ridiculous. I'm not the fastest in the bunch. I actually drop off the back. I'm not a pro athlete or have extensive athletic experience. And when I go up and do our like club races, I fall off the back of our C grade, which is ABC, the lowest grade for women sometimes. So for me to tell people that I was, oh yeah, I'm going to ride my bike across Australia and I'm going to do it in record time, felt really uncomfortable because I would expect that people would say, you? And the first attempt I made 6 months ago, I wasn't successful. And I think that whole journey of going out and doing something bigger than my capability and breaking down from the elements, from injury, and then learning from that and going and trying again is actually the whole story around the motivating piece for me to inspire others, especially my young family, my two children.
Yeah, that's awesome. And we should say as well, like, you are not a professional cyclist. Like, you know, your life doesn't revolve around that sport, right? You have a family, you have a somewhat normal, right, career and job. So what was the process just to obviously not, I mean, maybe you feel differently, but I would assume not just anybody could go out and do this without some level of training leading up to it. So how did you kind of look at that, not being some professional athlete attempting this, you know, world record, but as the average person that works every day and balances family and all the challenges that come with it? How did you prepare for this?
Yeah, it's a great question, Pat. And first of all, I had a great coach, Mark Fenner, who's based in France, and he built out my program. And it really helped having an external program because then it wasn't me demanding time and prioritizing training time in the structure of our family, but it was the program. So it was just in the calendar. And when my second child was born, what I realized is I had spent the first 2 years devoting so much time to being a mother while balancing work that my fitness had really fallen off and the prioritization around that. So how do you prepare? It's a lot of prioritization and it's a full family effort. So my rides take precedence over my partner's ride, which occasionally take precedence over family. Other things that we could be doing. But it's not only the riding, is it, Pat? We know these things with these ultra endurance type events, like when you just did the marathon, it's not just putting in the run training. but it's a whole of life, so it's going to bed at a decent hour. It's eating well. It's choosing to do an early morning bike ride over an evening social with friends. In fact, there's not a lot of friends that don't ride bikes because that's where the social happens. It's lowering stress levels. And preparing for an ultra-endurance event means that all of the training is done at recovery endurance pace. So there's no way to lift intensity or that TSS score besides quantity. There's no intensity intervals. Those workouts that can jump your total powers curve. The only way I can do that is through total time. And I was riding about, I'd say 15 to up to 20 hours a week, every week, consistently for a couple of years.
So when you were training for a couple of years, did you have the goal in mind that whole time?
I did. Yeah, wow. I did. It was about 18 months up until that first attempt of prioritizing the lifestyle required to get my fitness up to a level that could perform an endurance event like riding across Australia.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. All right. So I want to get into the ride, which myself and I know many others were following very closely on Instagram and elsewhere. Walk us through kind of define what you had to do first, but for people that don't know, obviously you had a time window, in logistically, what was kind of the plan going in for hours of riding each day and kind of what you had to check off each day?
Yeah, great question. So the record is either direction across the country, either Perth to Sydney, Sydney to Perth. Those are the two ends. We do have an Indy Pacific wheel race, but it's a longer route. And they were going out roughly the same time, a couple weeks before my second attempt. My attempt was just the fastest way across the country, which was 3,970 kilometers from A to B. How did we prepare and think about when we were going to go? Completely weather related. So we learned on the first attempt, we had in our minds, we were going to fly to Perth and ride across. And the weather conditions had changed, but we hadn't thought that we could change direction because we were so stuck into that set process that when we got to Perth and we started riding across, we hit unprecedented headwinds day after day. And so this time, the second attempt, we realized that weather is king. And whenever the best weather window was when we were going to make this attempt and from either location. So coming through in Australia through December, January, February, it was too hot. So we couldn't go in any of those months. And then March, we actually had hottest days on records as well. So it was still too hot to head out. So we started looking at April. And I said, I have to go between April and May because once we get into June, July, it's really cold and I do not do well with the cold. So it would have to be shelved again until coming through after the winter. And that's another 6 months of potentially training consistently, not getting sick, not doing anything else for another 6 months. And I said, no, I really just want to do this with this window that we have. So we have a friend who's really into weather science who is looking at the optimum weather window for us constantly and evaluating the patterns, as well as thinking about our work and professional services. We normally have a gap in client delivery over school holiday breaks. So we have a school holiday break coming up The other thing to think about, there's so many elements here, is who looks after our beautiful children. So our girls, Eleanor and Indira, are aged 6 and 8. In the last attempt, our wonderful mother-in-law looked after them. It was also during a school holiday period, and we realized that was quite taxing on her because they didn't have anything organized in the day. So it was a lot of care over the 12-day period, 2-week period. So what we did this time is we left with a few days while they were still in school, and we had some friends look after our children for us. A really beautiful community here. And we also have a 5-month-old puppy. So we had to organize care for her through our friends as well. And then my mother-in-law, Susan, came and looked after them for the bulk of the period while we were away during that holiday period. So, yeah, so we're thinking about when is the gap for work, when is the right time for care for our children, and also when's the best weather window. So all those three things aligned around this April period coming into the school holidays. But what happened was we had thought that the wind was in our favor leaving from Sydney. So everything we organized was leaving for Sydney. We still didn't have an exact date, probably up until a few days beforehand. And then we landed on this date and we said, this is going to be our date. We had a camper van sponsor and we had a leaving party and we had all these different groups of cycling groups coming to send us off from Sydney. 24 hours before departure, Mark's looking at the weather patterns and there's this cyclone that's just broken off the coast of Perth, which is shaking up the wind patterns. He writes a message to us that says, I am confident that leaving from Perth will be a better option. So with 24 hours to go, we say we can't have this camper van sponsor anymore. We buy 3 plane tickets for myself, my partner Nick, and our remedial massage therapist who has agreed to come with us to Perth, and we have to spend $8,000 on now renting a camper van to get us across the country. And we do that all within a day to go. So on the day we were going to depart, Sunday morning, we wake up 5 a.m., do the flight, the 5-hour flight to Perth. A friend picks us up over there, helps us get the camper van, get to the start. Nick and Ange have to buy all the groceries and supplies. And I hit the road at 2:18 p.m. to start the record ride that same day because we had 24 hours that we needed to get to Norseman before this weather changed on us and we would potentially start hitting some headwinds. So we had to get there within the 2 days, and I was really motivated. So that very first day, we got 200 kilometers in. I rode almost until midnight, and then we woke up at 3:15. The same morning, I guess, to put in another 360 kilometers, and then we kept rolling. Crazy. So you can crazy. See it. Yeah, it's not that cut and dry. It's not like here's race day, here's event time, plan up to it. It was very fluid until the final minute.
Yeah, for sure. So I have it correct to say that you ended up going the same way as your first attempt, correct?
That's right.
So would you say that was advantageous at the end of the day that you kind of knew that course going that direction?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I was really looking forward to leaving from Sydney because that's where all the climbing is as well. So I think leaving from Sydney, getting the climbing out of the way and looking at everything from a fresh perspective might have been good as well. But this is how it shook right. out and that's fine. So what it did give us was all of these benchmarks. So we could see, for those, I don't know if you do Zwift, but for those people who do Zwifting, there's now a function on there where you can see if you've done the same course, where you've done a better time in your current time. So it was like that for me in real life where I was like, oh, in the previous attempt, it took me 3 days to get here. And this time it only took me a day and a half. So we were able to see the same benchmarks and get and realize that we were getting through them much more quickly and with a lot less effort.
Right. So give us how many kilometers on average you had to go every day, and how were you breaking it up? You were obviously getting up at like early morning to begin. Were you going straight through every day? Were you taking breaks based on you needed it, or were you adhering to some kind of schedule or exact distance each day?
Yeah. So the current record set in 1998 was 13 days and 2 hours. We realized I'd have to ride 340 kilometers a day to make 12 days.
Oh my goodness.
I forgot about the 340.
I didn't know it was that much.
Yeah, I forgot about the 340 from the first attempt, and for some reason I had in my mind that it had to be 360, which was actually a good thing. So, because I was trying to hit 360 or above.
Do you know how much that is in miles for the US listeners, roughly?
Sorry, no.
Okay, I'll do the calculation for them.
Thank you, sorry.
It's a lot.
So that was the plan. Mark Beaumont is the fastest male to circumnavigate the globe by bicycle. And he had a method of 4 blocks of 4 hours. And I thought that seemed like a good plan. So we adopted that plan. And how that works is I would ride by time instead of distance. So waking up around 3:15, 3:30, doing a facilitated stretch and getting ready to get on the bike and then riding for a 4 hour block and then having a 20 minute break and then a 4 hour block, 20 minute break all the way throughout the day. So those 20 minute breaks we would use to completely reset. I'd have a quick rub anywhere where there was some niggles by Ange, potentially a hot meal. My bike would be serviced, or later on towards the tail end of the 11 days, I would have a quick nap. So I would literally shoes and helmet, glasses, everything still on, just lie down 10 minutes and feel refreshed within that 20 minute break. And the 4 hours works really well because it's the structure that contains effort. So in my mind, I approached each 4 hour block as its own ride. And I would say to myself, I only have to ride 4 hours. That's it. And most of us can ride 4 hours. And in that 4 hour block, I would have these little mind tricks with myself, like 1 hour in, good job, Christina, you've already done 1 hour. And then 2 hours halfway, easy. And where I live in Sydney, one of our main rides, flat rides, is called to Church Point and Back, which can be about 90 minutes to 2 hours. So around that 2 hour mark, I would say to myself, this is only Church Point and Back and you're done. Mm-hmm. And then after that 4 hour was finished, I would celebrate, have my little reset, and then approach the next 4 hour ride as a brand new ride. And by doing that, at the end of the 11 days, when people ask me now, does it feel like you achieved something? It doesn't really, because my mind contained each 4 hour block, that all I feel like I've done is a 4 hour ride, but just four of them a day, 11 days in a row.
Right. Yeah, it's a mind trick, right? Because if you were to think about the fact that you have to ride for, say, 8 more days versus 2 more hours every time you're on the bike,
yeah,
you, I would imagine, just be like so overwhelmed by, you know, the enormity of that, given the fact that you're tired, everything hurts, you know, big trucks are whizzing by you that are probably, you know, shaking your bike and everything. To think that you have to do that for 8 more days versus 2 more hours would just be a total mental letdown.
That's exactly it. And I think there's different ways endurance athletes can strategize these types of rides. And I think some, what I've seen endurance riders do is go so hard straight out for as long as they can and then sleep little bits. But for me, the structure really worked, and it really worked in a supported situation with my team, because my team also knew when their rest points were and what I needed. And it just had the whole kind of cadence work to sustain us over those 11 days. And it was different from the first attempt, because in the first attempt, I remember in some of those earlier days, imagining coming into Manly and what that would feel like. Whereas this time, I knew there was that result of wanting to win a record, but then it was absolved. I didn't think about the finish really until I was really quite close to Sydney. I brought my attention entirely, maybe to the end of the day, but really to just that 4-hour block. So my mind was always in present time in exactly what I needed to accomplish. And by accomplishing each 4-hour block, we eventually get our result, even though we're not thinking about that throughout the experience itself.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you mentioned, and we're kind of dancing around it a little bit, but you had mentioned to me previously that the hardest part of it was the mental aspect. Outside of, you know, the enormity of what you're doing and kind of that trick of chunking it down to these 4-hour segments, can you talk about some of the other mental challenges and what mental tactics you used to overcome them as you went?
Yeah, it is very psychological. I think the stress. The biggest ones are weather and traffic for me. So being out in the middle of Australia, there's no urban life at all. So from outside of Perth to coming into Sydney, which is 3,900 kilometers. I'm sorry, you'll have to do the math on the miles there. I literally stopped at 3 traffic lights. So there are not hours, but days of just vast landscape. And in those, especially throughout the Nullarbor, which means absence of trees, the wind and the elements have so much impact. So I would be constantly in my periphery looking at the way the grass was blowing on either side of the road. So if the grass is going this way, I'm feeling great. The grass is going this way or this way, different feelings. Because you just know as a cyclist the strain of having to work against the wind or a crosswind as well, having to hold that bike upright. There's a next level of weariness and physical toll, but the mentality of knowing that you're working against something you can't control is quite challenging. So dealing with that, with the cold, with rain, with some occasionally waking up in pouring rain so hard you can't even see through. Those are all things that cannot be controlled. And so my hacks to get through those, I had, besides the structure, the 4-hour block, like I only have to withstand this for 4 hours. I had 2 other ones. The second one was about digging deeper into my why and why I was there in the first place. And that's really about inspiring others to make big, bold decisions. So when I leaned into that and said, I'm doing this not just for myself, but to be a story for others, I would almost imagine those others, those nameless others, almost as like a peloton with me. So feeling that connection to my purpose helped me mentally stay focused through that external, those external elements that I couldn't control. And then the other one was to allow myself to embrace them. So this is can be quite challenging when the wind, especially as a headwind, when it's relentless, to say, you know, thank you. I recognize that you're here, wind. And regardless of you being here, I'm still choosing to be here. So I think when we're in things we can't control, realizing that we still choose that puts the control back, gives the control back to me. So if it's pouring rain and there's a wind and I'm trying to ride, I just say to myself, okay, this is unpleasant. And, but would I choose, really actually choose to be in the support vehicle right now? No. Would I actually choose to be home and not where I am right now? No. I actually choose, even as hard as all these uncontrollables are, I choose to be here. And choosing it means that I'm embracing the challenge and it makes it easier. So those are my other two main hats that I employed for the weather. For the traffic's the next story. The traffic's the hardest psychologically. And where I encountered following the event, a little of the post-stress, waking up with that deeper anxiety of the traffic. So one of Nick's best friends, Toby, was killed by a road train while riding in his shoulder. And he was being safe. It was the driver who didn't see him and his friend, who were both killed instantly. And being out there on some of these roads where the shoulder's not great, I'm navigating this like tiny little strip outside of a line, or there's gravel or there's nothing. And then these road trains and the constant traffic, especially getting like outside from Wagga to Sydney, was the worst, because you start to get more into that city type speed. And they're just vroom, vroom, like we shouldn't be as little humans on bikes next to that type of movement at that speed constantly. And so I had this high vigilance and alertness required at all times, that almost touched to death, that anxiety of making sure that I was visible, making sure that they were constantly aware of me, and having and being as safe as I possibly could at all times. And sometimes the trucks were actually, with the wind, made things feel less safe, because they would exacerbate the conditions of the wind. And so I was constantly working out every time a truck passed, how I could be the most safe position. Being a mother, having children, our risk tolerances are different. And I would always make the safer option, which at sometimes probably wasn't the most speediest option. So I chose safety over speed, even though I was going for a record. But yeah, it's that, I think what people don't realize with these types of attempts is that mental vigilance. And my brain was always on, my brain was always working, because it's constantly surveying for obstacles and challenges, what's ahead in my view, scanning. A couple times kangaroos ran right out in front of me. And you know, they run across fast, so a hit with them. So I'm just constantly scanning, listening, trying to make sure traffic's aware of me. And it's this real mental, constant attention that is more significant, I think, than the physical effort. Because I'd been training for the endurance, so I knew if I just sat on my bike, I could just pedal recovery. That's fine. But having to navigate those other conditions, I think, is what made me more weary than just doing the physical effort itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that make sense? All those inputs, and I can certainly relate to not to at all the extent you had to deal with it, but just simply being on a bike and having a big Mack truck drive by you, and it can almost literally knock you over. And to have that constantly, like, and I've had bike accidents as well, and just having the courage to get back on the bike after one of those Mack trucks almost knocked you over, or, you know, you had a close call, is a real mental grind. And then when you tack on lack of sleep and all the other stressful factors that you were going through for 11 days straight, I can't even imagine the mental fortitude needed to just get back on the bike after that 4-hour chunk every time.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And we did make a mistake from Wagga, because we only had 500 kilometers to go. And we said, let's do all 5 kilometers in one go.
Mm-hmm.
That was a mistake. Because not having the rigor of the 4-hour blocks anymore actually made us less efficient over time. And the traffic that was so intense. So riding all night, because we left Wagga and the plan was to ride all night through this busy highway stretch, and a fog descended. So the visibility was null. And I came up to this road closure and a traffic controller was there. And she said, what possesses you to ride a push bike in the middle of the night on a highway? And I said, yeah, that's a fair question. I was still kind of feeling okay at that point. But then the fog got worse. And the level of anxiety was going up. And I came into, and Nick's like, are you going okay? And I said, no, I need to stop, because it wasn't that I physically couldn't ride. It was I mentally couldn't hold the space anymore to ride with such low visibility in a highly dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up sleeping from, I think, 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. and then trying to go again when there was a little bit more light, because the sun was rising, but there was still fog. And so basically had 2 hours of sleep over a 40-hour period, because my riding was such a lower speed. Plus we had the headwinds, plus we were riding through the divide the range, so there was climbing. And then coming down, the biggest highway piece into Sydney was supposed to be an 80-kilometer descent into Sydney, but now we're back into night again. Haven't slept since that 2-hour block the previous night. And the conditions, the road conditions were horrendous. And I can't see except for my bike light. But there's also the vroom, the traffic lights. So it's almost like a disco, right? Of them going past constantly. And so it felt almost, I'm guessing, say individuals who are in the army who have to do this physical activity and then do a mental exam, mm-hmm. kind of felt like having to play chess on your on total fragility, navigating all the debris in the roads and the cracks and the bumps and the dead animals against massive traffic who may or may not see me because I'm in the dark, was probably not the most clever thing to do. The clever thing would have been to do the proper structure all the way through. But sometimes right. we think there's only like a little bit left, like say if we're on like a project and we're just going to work all night, not really knowing what all the obstacles are, it's actually less efficient than keeping to the protocols and the plan.
Right. Right. So the other, at least as an outsider looking in, the other sort of endurance hack or thing I thought you used very well, again, as an outsider looking in, was humor. You know, mm-hmm. it felt like, I mean, even from your initial announcement that you were going to do it, you know, you're kind of making fun of yourself. And then the whole time it just felt like you weren't taking yourself or what you were doing too seriously. Was that intentional mm-hmm. or is that just you? How did you kind of, what was like the mindset from like a, like you were never intense, like I'm going to, you know, maybe you were at certain times, but, you know, we never saw it. It was always you kind of laughing at yourself and laughing at situations that, you know, unideal situations that came up.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. And I think that comes with being in the present moment, right? So those 20-minute pit stops with Ange and Nick were the best. They were so joyful. And I loved having Ange on the journey because what I would always try and work out was how to make her laugh. And that just gave me something to focus on. Like, I'd look over and I'd like say something, and just getting her to crack a smile really lightened me up as well. And having those moments and experiences of joy, I think is definitely what elevated the whole experience for us and made it a really beautiful journey. Because that's for me what it was about. It was about being in that journey. And I think the laughing about the is important because it brings the joy in. So I was always kind of hanging for those moments to crack the smile, make the joke, which might have come through on the camera because that's what I was creating. And also because I wanted them to feel good and be happy. I mean, they're out there looking after me, but I also, in a reciprocal way, also wanted to do my part in returning the favor and looking after them at the same time. And I did that through trying to create those mini moments of joy. But I will say, I can be quite serious as well. So when I was out there in those 4-hour blocks, I have this alter ego sometimes of a tiger that I let go of. And it's just that pure focus and intensity to drive actually as fast and as hard as I can in while I was out there on the bike. So you probably didn't see that intensity as much because it would have been harder to film. But I did feel that seriousness during the actual work. And then I would come up and lighten the mood during my breaks. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, the on the field, off the field, you know, you could, like any great athlete, you can flip the switch when you need to, right? And go into that more focused, serious state. So tell us what it was like, right? You set out to set this world record. You're now day 11 and change, coming into the final few miles. There's a bunch of people that show up and ride with you. There's a whole crowd waiting for you at the end. What was that moment like for you when you knew you had done it and everybody that loves you was there to celebrate it with you?
Yeah, that was really beautiful. So the running into the finish, that plan of going the 500Ks right away didn't work out. And we were creeping later and later into the night. And I said to Nick, you know, I just want to get this done. And all I was visioning at that point, because I was allowing myself to imagine the finish, was getting to Manly, smelling the ocean, being there connected to the environment, dipping my wheel into the water, which is the custom, and then going home and crawling into bed with my 6-year-old daughter, Eleanor. And that's what I had pictured. So because it was midnight and it was pouring hard, thundering rain, I really had no expectations. So seeing my friend show up, probably about 20 or so kilometers from the finish, was really surprising. I said, what are you doing here? Don't you know it's the middle of the night? And it's on a Thursday, so I know people work the next day. And the other thing with the requirements, the Guinness requirements, is nobody was allowed to ride with me, not even behind me. They had to be 5 bikes lengths behind me. So she was riding far behind me. And then coming through the city, I think she expected I was really tired and overwhelmed. So she was making me stop at every traffic light, even though there's nobody in the city. We're stopping and it's pouring rain. And she says, oh, and this other friend, Jay, is going to meet us in Camaray in Neutral Bay, which is probably about 8 kilometers from the finish. I said, okay, that's surprising. But we get up to Neutral Bay, and I'm riding ahead of her, and I just see this sea of bike lights, and a woo! And there was, you know, like a dozen women out there to ride at 12:30 in the morning. And they all had to ride 5 bike lengths behind me. So I'd stop at a traffic light. They'd stop at a traffic light 5 bike lengths behind. And I'd look back and all I would see is their bike lights and them going, woo! So I was really surprised. And then coming into Manly, yeah, there must have been so many people. Plus a cameraman, plus my daughters. What are you girls doing out here? And I just felt a really surprised and a bit awkward, to be honest. Yeah. So, and then everybody wanted to chat and congratulate me, and I just felt really confused and was looking forward to going home and cuddling with my daughter. So after about half an hour, I cycled home afterwards. Because our camper van had broken down, so I had to cycle back home and take off my, not far, like 5 kilometers, take off my wet clothes that I had been in for so long, very beautiful cycling clothes, I should add, and and grubby, and take a warm shower and then crawl into that bed with my 6-year-old, was the most really beautiful feeling.
Hmm.
Yeah.
When did it, or has it, sank in?
Not really, because it just feels like I went for a bike ride.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't feel too exceptional. But I, yeah. what I did is I had so much time out there to have conversations with myself and to just be present in the great, beautiful expanse of the world. So I was cycling, you know, just felt like into these sunrises and then into the moon rises. And I'd still be riding like day after day through all of this space. And so I had a lot of reflection time to think about things that I want to do in work and who I am as a person. And I just felt this really deep connection to myself and my surroundings and this internal worthiness. So with that connection means that any result it's not the important thing. What's important is actually how confident, that inner confidence that I have. And that I think I'll lean into other aspects in my life going forward. They don't necessarily have to be other athletic pursuits. I just feel this sense of inner accomplishment and connection to the beauty that I experienced.
Mm.
So I think that's awesome. A longer term gain. That's not necessarily how do I feel about having accomplished something. It's more this, I'm going to lean into that sense of worth and beauty, I think, for days and years to come.
Yeah. Do you think that realization is achieved by, you know, that personal, you know, that ease with yourself and that confidence in yourself? Does that come from doing hard things, from doing things out of your comfort zone? Do you feel that's kind of the path to, you know, being at a place that is okay with you and confident with who you are?
Yeah, in some ways, yes. And in some ways, no, because they have to be, when you say doing hard things, they have to be hard, like your real hard thing inside.
Mm.
And your real hard thing is different from what others may perceive or external expectations or external culture say are hard things. So a hard thing for you might actually be, you know, having that really uncomfortable conversation with your partner, or it might be leaving, doing something different in work, or like you have to have that sense of accomplishment, that real internal lit up confidence has to be attached to something inside yourself. And only you can know that for you. To do a hard thing that culturally or like that other people would consider doing a hard thing, like getting a promotion or buying whatever it is, and you gain that without that inner connection, then you don't get there's not the same satisfaction. So, and it's different for everyone. My 8-year-old daughter is, she's definitely more on the introverted side. Like, she would prefer, hands down, to stay home and read than to go to a birthday party with her friends. And she's perfectly okay with missing parties because she'd rather be reading. And so she doesn't do a lot of things on her own or outside of her family unit. And the other day, she really wanted to get an ice block, and neither my partner or I would take her to our local IGA, our local shop, which is about 1 kilometer away in distance. So she finally said, well, I'm going to go on my own. And we said, go for it. So she had her $5 and off she went. She walked up to the shops. She navigated what to buy. She got 2 ice blocks, one for her, one for her younger sister, you know, paid for it, walked home with the ice blocks. She didn't open them till she got here. And she just had this total sense of satisfaction of navigating that whole experience on her own. And at night when I was cuddling her in bed, and I said, so how do you feel after what you did today? And she said, Mom, I'm feeling so many feelings. And I'm feeling excitement, and I'm feeling, I think she was looking for the word pride, but she didn't know it. And she said, and I'm feeling ignition. That is such a good word. Like, just, you know, like, start it up. So for her, that was her hard thing. So we don't need to all go and cycle across Australia to find our sense of worthiness. I think it's about identifying where you're at and what for you is your hard thing to scale.
Yeah, that's so well said. So you have done this thing again. I'll keep saying unofficial when it comes to the record, but you have done this. I know you set out to do it for, you know, your kids and to set some type of example for them. What is that, other than some of the things we've discussed, what is that greater message? And is it different than you thought it was going to be when you set out to do it?
Yeah, I suppose some of it's different in that this was my second attempt. So the first one, I realized there's a really strong message around culturally being good with failure, and that failure is part of the journey to success. I thought that I would go out last time and that my mentality was strong enough that I would just get myself through it. And almost like David Goggins style, it's like, come on, body, let's go. Keep driving, you can do this. And there's so much messaging in our world that says that if you just put your head down and work hard to get hard enough, you'll achieve. However, the goal I had set myself was bigger than what I could achieve. And I think that is a message right there, Pat, is that we can strive for things that are bigger than ourselves, but we have to be okay with falling short. So if there's so much social culture around us around being successful, it's really hard to come up short. And we may choose things that fall within the boundaries of what's possible for us to make sure that, maybe subconsciously, but that success is inevitable, that we get that win. So the pushing myself through didn't actually work because the elements were strong enough. I didn't have the right team. I didn't have the right capability. I had injury and I had to reconcile with the fact that I couldn't do it. And that, I think, was the best message for my children, actually. Because, for example, with my 8-year-old, she was talking about, she's at a new school and they had to put up their hands if they wanted to be on the school council. And she didn't put her hand up. I said, why didn't you put your hand up? Because that's the harder thing, is saying, yes, I want to even try out for something that she knows that she'd be good at, but she was too scared to do. So for me, it's saying, yeah, I did this really hard thing and it didn't work out. And I'm still good with that because I put my hand up. I put myself out there to do something that I didn't think I could do. And I tried anyways. And then I learned from that. I built a better team. I looked at better weather. I built up my strength, my capability, and I tried again. And so I think that bigger arc is the lesson that I wasn't expecting, that I'll be able to share with my girls around doing hard things, being okay with them not working out, because it's part of the journey and it's part of the learning to where we eventually might get to if we keep working and keep trying again. And that might be a note that's missing in the social discourse when we see somebody go out and then we see them successful. And we think, okay, if I do this, I'll go out and then I'll be successful and I'll get the prize. But there's, for every one person we see that, there might be like 100 or 1,000 people that have also gone out but hadn't gotten that success. But it's not the story. It's not the narrative that we show around because it's not as showy. It's not as beautiful. And so I really wanted to share the fact that I did fail and I'm good with that. And we should talk more about doing things to that point of failure because that means we're trying something hard or harder than we think we're capable of. So that's the newer message that I'm really excited about sharing about. and we do hear that sometimes, like, oh, what did you fail at today? But I don't think it's really deep within our culture. I don't think we're really good with being comfortable with being okay to fail.
I love it. As you were talking, I was thinking about my marathon run, because I personally, I want to attempt something I'm not sure I can do. You know, it's like, I know I can run a marathon, and I have a triathlon coach who is helping me, you know, with the marathon training. And he was like, you know, you've run this time in training, you know, just put your heart rate monitor on, keep your heart rate under this, you know, beats per minute, you know, the whole time. And if you still have stuff in your legs, you know, go for it the last couple miles. And, you know, you'll run a 305, 310 or whatever. And it's like, I already know I can do that, right? That isn't, for me, I gain nothing by going out and just doing what I already know I can do. So, you know, just setting that more aggressive goal that it's possible, like, I know it's possible, but I'm not sure I can accomplish it. Even if I don't accomplish it, I learn so much more about myself by attempting the bigger thing that's on my edge. And I'd rather live there than setting goals I know I can achieve.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. That's how I think about it.
Exactly. But you have to be good with not achieving them.
That's totally. The thing. Yeah, totally. Totally. And so go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, I was going to say, thinking about being okay with not achieving them, sometimes those results are the external pieces. So again, it's going deeper into the purpose and the why. So for your run, looking towards you may or may not succeed or fail in that attempt, there's probably a deeper motivation or why that you connect to that is stronger and allows you to withstand the success or the failure, because both are challenging. And for me, that deeper why, so the failure of the attempt or the success of the attempt, both of them mean the same in a way to me. Like, I'm not connected significantly to either, because the deeper why around inspiring others was successful in both. And actually, when I failed, there were so many people that told me that I had that following that journey and being okay with the failure inspired them to make decisions in their life to do hard things. And I've had the same response with having the successful attempt. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. Yeah. The outcome doesn't really matter, right?
If you're connected to a deeper sense of your own personal why.
Yeah, I love that.
So what is it for you?
Mine is certainly just to inspire people to lead healthier lives, but specifically on the plant-based side. You know, I really feel like physically, as an athlete, I've been given the certain athletic gifts as a person, and you know, I want to inspire other people and let them know that they don't need to sacrifice their long-term health for athletic performance in any way. And all that's possible on, you know, choosing to live a certain way. Because I personally had so many, you know, I didn't think you could build muscle or perform a certain way, you know, if you didn't eat animal products, you know, many years ago. I truly did not think that was the case. And, you know, I don't know if it's healthy to kind of want to prove people wrong. I guess I want to prove myself right more than anything else, but I just want to inspire, and I want people to know that you don't need to sacrifice longevity, right? To me, it's the same thing. Longevity and athletic performance is the same thing. You know, the goal is a properly high-functioning body, and the same things that keep you disease-free are the same things that keep you high-performing as an athlete. And I think that is very lost when it comes to competing in athletics. It's all about how do we get through today's workout? And I don't care what the long-term effects of that are on my health and my body. And I just don't think that's a positive way, especially for young people, to have that relationship with physical activity, if that makes sense.
Oh, for sure. Yep. And that's one thing you haven't asked me, is that I'm also plant-based.
Yeah, we haven't even got into it. Can you touch on why you are and only if you have time. I know we're going way longer than planned here.
Yeah.
Do you have a few minutes, or do you want to, wrap up as well?
No, that's good. I'm good. So our whole family's plant-based. So my girls, who are 6 and 8, have never consumed meat or fish or direct dairy. We're not militant, so they have had birthday cake or a croissant here and there.
Sure.
But they wouldn't consume dairy directly. And they're pretty healthy girls. I did have their bloods checked, and it was funny because the doctor called back and said, what are you feeding these children? They have astronomical B12. Because B12 is one of the markers for deficiency for a plant-based diet. And I said, I'm not supplementing anything, actually. I do supplement like a iron and multivitamin or a vitamin C now. But then I wasn't. And it's because they consume so much of what's called nutritional yeast or savory yeast or plant-based cheese. Like they sprinkle it on everything. So I think it comes from that. But they had like 10 times the required B12. So they're good. And I moved from a kind of a vegetarian based diet to a plant-based diet in 2012. And so that was, I guess, 11 years ago. And I grew up as a child in Canada on a normal pork roast Sunday night type of diet. And then when I was 18 and I moved out on my own, I just started to purchase less animal products because I just couldn't validate it to myself. It just felt weird, but I didn't know anything. I didn't dig into it more. It just didn't feel right. I moved to Guatemala and then I moved to the Caribbean, and the same thing, except in the Caribbean, there's a lot of fried chicken and I would fish. So there was those elements in my diet, but again, I didn't seek them out or purchase them to cook in my home often. And then in 2012, I did this really big adventure learning global program where I looked at the supply chain of t-shirts and shoes. And through that investigation, I started to understand where things come from. So we were visiting farms and factories and designers and looking at the origin of materials of these products and then creating curriculum for students in classrooms. And I had global education partners, and one of my partners was the Institute for Humane Education, which is actually near you guys in New England. And so Wild came on board as one of my partners, and I was having a conversation with her. And she said, "This is great. I love everything you're doing." She has a great TED Talk as well around the origin of the t-shirt. And she says, "But what about the animals?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean about the animals?" She said, "Well, what about their impact in the supply chain of the t-shirt and shoes?" And I really wanted her as a partner, so I said, "Okay, I'll look into it. You know, we'll do a module on animals as well." And and then that was the catalyst in doing the research. So I started to research animals' involvement and industrial farming and so many things that I had never even thought about. And I visited sheep farms and started to learn about the fact that I didn't even think about this, that sheep actually have tails, but and that milk comes from cows because cows are mothers. All of that was new. So all of that was new, and my partner and I are both individuals that once we learn something, we make immediate change. So as soon as we learned about the environmental impacts, the humane considerations, and the ethical, all of that, as soon as we learned it, we made immediate change. And in 2012, we went from a mostly vegetarian diet to a complete vegan diet and haven't looked back.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, I don't want to keep you too much longer. I know. I'm sure you have a busy day ahead of you still. Do you want to quickly? I know you're working on some things. I don't know if you want to say what you're working on and give people a heads up, but then also, where can people follow you? Where can they? Just follow everything you're up to. And like I said, if you want to, announce some things that you're working on, fire away.
Follow me just at Christina Rivers on Instagram. Working on, do you mean in terms of professional work?
Either or, but I meant more creating a film around the ride and things you had mentioned. I don't know if you want to talk about those things.
Gotcha. So I would like to say that doing the second attempt, it happened, like things came around quite quickly because it was probably around 2 weeks' notice that we started to really say, okay, we're going to do this soon. And I had reached out to Plan Athletic on Instagram to say, hey, your guys' kit is really great. Would you consider being a partner and sponsoring me? And they came back right away to say, yeah. And that was really helpful to give me the confidence that I was on the right track and reach out to other beautiful sponsors. So really grateful to all the beautiful people that came on board to help pay for the costs of doing the adventure. And I want to do everything I can to help pay those people back in a way that elevates their brands and their support. So, looking at definitely pulling together a film from the footage of the experience and perhaps both experiences together to get that longer journey, that bigger arc. And we're going to be looking at how we can use this as a platform to inspire other women to ride. We might look at doing some groups and some initiatives around supporting the culture of women in sport, and especially around cycling. And I do facilitate cycling education at my children's school. So again, using this inspiration to help excite and bring on more. Not only cycling, but just commuting to school through one's own means instead of through cars. And looking forward to how I can use this adventure in all aspects of my work and life going forward.
Amazing, amazing. Well, I want to give you, before we sign off, one last shout out here. Just congratulations. It was not only super inspiring to watch, but it was just, like I have told you before, it was a clinic, at least from the outside looking in, a mental toughness clinic, and a physical toughness clinic. And it was just so impressive to watch, and you should be so proud of yourself for even attempting it, but also the fact that you accomplished it. And from the Plant Athletic side, as you know, we had just taken over that brand weeks before we got your message, and it was the perfect thing to energize us and get us excited about what we can build a community around. So thank you for that. And like I said before, you don't owe us anything. We owe you something, and we were just so honored to be a part of it. So thank you for reaching out, and I'm so glad that we have connected on this level now, and I hope we can do many things in the future together. With myself and Plant Athletic and you, and yeah, congrats. It's just such a badass, amazing thing you have accomplished, and I hope you know that.
Oh, thank you. That's really lovely of you to say. And it was
well,
lovely to
thank
chat.
you. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
All right, we'll talk soon.